My name again is Ann Woodward, my husband David. To do a brief introduction for those of you who may be new this morning, David was born and raised to missionary parents in Iran and lived there until he was 11 years old. Came back to the States and graduated from the University of Washington with a master's degree in Near East Language and Literature, and is currently the director of the Intensive English Language Institute at Seattle Pacific University. I bring a different perspective to the class. I'm a native Seattleite, born and raised in Seattle, never lived anywhere else until I lived for a year in Kuwait. We lived there together, so David's has also been in Kuwait. I studied history at the University of Washington for part of my time there under Professor Jerry Bacharach. And for those of you who at least get Seattle radio and television, Jerry Bacharach was one of the consultants that a couple of stations used during the Gulf War. He's currently the chair of the Department of History at the University of Washington. Today, again, we're going to go back into the Middle East and take a look at their religion and sort of the beginnings of Islam and what that meant then and what that means now for the people today as we take a look at understanding Middle Eastern people. First of all, David's writing some terms up on the board for you that you may have heard, and we'll cover those as we go through the class and help define what those mean. I want to describe a little bit for you what the world that Muhammad was born into. Muhammad was born around 570 or 580. It's sort of not, I recall 580 in the book that we referred you to, The Concise History of the Middle East, in the bookstore says 570, so we'll go with that one for the time being. And he was born into a world where the Christian church, there were several sort of heretical movements that had come out of the Christian church. The Christian church had been going for about 500 years. And those groups, as they were sort of mucking about, were sent down into the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, were sort of cast out of the Holy Land region. And a couple of those groups, just to give you a brief description, the Nestorians, you may have heard of, Their basic tenet of theology was that they overemphasized the humanity of Christ and sort of denied his deity. And the Monophysites, who overemphasized the deity of Christ and really minimized his humanity. Also, as well, at that time, there were quite a few pagans who had multiple gods that they were worshiping. So this is the world that Muhammad was born into.
Well, they had a god for every day of the year. In the Kaaba in Mecca, where they now worship, they had a god all the way around. They had a god for each day, so they had that was the heart of Arab belief at that time.
So Muhammad came into this time, in this period, and had several visions. Do you want to describe?
Yeah, Muhammad had been a very earnest young man. He was a trader and illiterate, and apparently had just had a real longing to know more about the great God that the Christian people that were around him and the Jews worshipped, and he was interested in this Allah person. And so, as some of the other ascetics around him, he would go up to the mountains and he would meditate, and he claimed that he received a vision, and that it was Gabriel who came to him and said, "Say, recite." And then Gabriel gave him something to recite. And he came back to his wife and Khadija, and he said, "You know, I don't know what to do about this." And she said, "Well, God's chosen you, obviously. You know, come on, you're a prophet." And she encouraged him to start telling his message.
And so then Muhammad went to both the Christians and the Jews that were around at that time to call them back to the one God, and basically was not received well. As a matter of fact, there was a Jewish community in Medina at the time.
We should identify these places.
Okay.
here's Mecca on the western side of Saudi Arabia, and still there today. And Medina. Medina means city. And by the way, in Bellevue, maybe you know Seattle?
Medina.
I'm sure that's from Medina. It should be Medina, which means the city. But he went from Mecca eventually up to Medina to get his base going, because these people rejected him and threatened to kill him, in fact. It was only because he was protected by Abu Bakr, an uncle, in a very powerful tribe, that he wasn't killed. By the way, do you want to read maybe just a little so they can see what the Quran sounds like? And then I can say it in Arabic.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say briefly, though, the Jewish community, Medina, rejected Muhammad. And when he then established power, he massacred the group of Jews.
Well, Muslims today claim that he didn't order the massacre, but that this in fact happened, and so the beginning of the animosity.
So the Jews were banished then from the peninsula, and some of them went down into Yemen. So that there's a group of Jews in Yemen, but the rest of them then left the peninsula. You want me to read this part?
Yeah, just that. This is the opening surah, or chapter of the Quran, which is most often recited in prayers, and it gives you a sense of the Quranic message and the kind of things that are in it.
In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate. Praise belongs to God, the Lord of all being, and the all-merciful, the all-compassionate, the master of the day of doom. Thee only we serve, to thee alone we pray for succor. Guide us in the straight path, the path of those whom thou hast blessed, not of those against whom thou art wrathful, nor of those who are astray. So it's a real...
Recite in Arabic.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
It goes like this. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I have to check my notes here because I knew this would happen. Alhamdulillah ar-Rabbil alameen, Rahman ar-Rahim, Maliki yawm ad-Din, Iyaka na'budu wa Iyaka nasta'een, Ihdina as-sirat al-mustaqeem, صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. And I recite it so you get a sense of the sort of hypnotic effect. This is very important to Muslims. They believe that you really have to read the Quran in Arabic to get the full impact. And this has been a point of contention for centuries. They believe that if you translate the Quran, you take away from the full meaning of it.
Because this is not the Quran translated, this is the Quran interpreted. So it's not translated into English, it's interpreted into English.
Technically, the Quran in Orthodox Muslim belief was written down before time. That is, written down, it's eternal in their mind. And that
God speaks Arabic.
That God used Arabic, that Arabic is the language of God, and so he had written the Quran in Arabic. So it's very closely tied in to Arabic culture and language, and one can't really overemphasize that fact. So therefore you have Indonesians, that's why I brought this magazine. Does anybody have the magazine from Aramco? Right, if you want to just sort of hold that front picture so people can see the picture on the front, that's an image of an Islamic image, but that's not the Middle East. That's somewhere in Asia. Well, the largest Muslim nation is Indonesia. See, not Saudi Arabia, which is only maybe 15 million Muslims. Indonesia has 200 million Muslims. So that gives you a sense of, oh, okay, I thought, you know, Arabs were Muslims, but most Muslims are not Arabs. Most Muslims are Indonesian, Bengali, and Pakistani, and Indian.
Just to finish a little bit with Muhammad here, when, as David's written on the board, I went, Islam means submission. Muslim is one who submits. And so, from what I've studied and understand, Muhammad's intention was not to start another religion, but was to call the people back to the one God. And he didn't set up a successor. He didn't set up all these rules. Those came after his death. So that his initial intention, and he felt he was in line sort of with the prophets of the Old Testament. And Muslims today see him as the seal of the prophets or whatever, and then they use the verse in the New Testament when Christ promises to send the Holy Spirit,
the Comforter,
by changing, what is it, a vowel or something in.
Well, they translate it from Greek to Arabic, and then using a certain translation, then they can take that form and derive another form, which means Muhammad.
Yeah, mm-hmm. as opposed to the Holy Spirit. So they believe that Jesus promised another prophet, that he promised Muhammad. So, and we can go into more of their view on who Christ was later, but do you want to?
Sure. I wanted to go back a minute.
Questions?
Yeah, sure.
Were there questions on that?
Last night we just rattled on the whole time and didn't give people enough chance.
So much to cover.
Yeah.
Two questions, non-related. Is there still a Jewish community in Yemen?
Yeah, isn't there?
I believe there still are.
What percentage of the population? It's not a very populous nation.
Very small. Well, Yemen, south and north together, has about 17 million.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's actually a very significant Arab country today, and going to be more so. But I would imagine there's just a few hundred thousand.
You might want to point to that.
Jews there.
Where Yemen is?
Yeah, I know.
Oh, yeah, right here. This area here.
And the second question was the comment about God spoke Arabic in the eternal language. I've heard, and I was wondering, I was looking for confirmation that Arabic might have been the everyday language in Israel in Christ's time, that he himself might have spoke.
Well, Aramaic was.
Aramaic.
Yeah.
Aramaic.
And Aramaic is a very close cousin to Arabic.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and then yesterday, I don't know if you were here yesterday, but David mentioned that
Hebrew
is so closely related to Arabic.
Okay.
Right, and in fact, the Jews of Yemen, if you listen to their music, if you've ever heard their music, it's just like what Arabs hear every day. I mean, they're so close culturally that it's just a minor distinction of, well, it's doctrinal distinction, but other than that, they're inseparable from Arab people.
In
Oriental Jews, they really are very much like Arab people.
In features, someone asked if we could tell the difference between Iranian and Arab. I was surprised after having known so many Arabs and then to see Jewish people in Egypt. We got a chance to go to Egypt. To see Jewish people in Egypt look very similar to Arabs to me.
They dress the same.
Very similar.
Speak Arabic beautifully.
And that was a real big surprise for me because I thought that would be obviously a big distinction, but they're definitely cousins.
Was Muhammad's intent or original message complicated unnecessarily or corrupted by his followers or his disciples?
That's a great question. That's what this refers to here. The Quran is as it was compiled together, was sort of the authoritative version of the recitations. And these were added to eventually through his lifetime to be compiled in one book. Alternating versions were destroyed in about 70 years after Muhammad and by the Caliph Uthman. So now there are no competing versions of the Quran. So there's just one version. So therefore Muslims will say that their book is pure where the Christian scriptures have been corrupted. But in any case, after his death, the traditions about his life and practice were written down and added to and embellished over the centuries. And so you find interesting oral traditions that were then written down, which clearly could not have happened during his lifetime, but somebody would think, well, this is probably what he would have done. And so the hadith ended up growing and growing over the next few centuries and is a very important part of. And the way they would do it is somebody would say, I heard it from so-and-so, who heard it from so-and-so, who heard it from so-and-so. And that's very much part of the Middle Eastern oral tradition, is that you have an isnad or a line of derivation, who you heard it from, who heard it from, who heard it from. And then eventually it was written down. And this is often in contradiction to the actual Quranic material. But Muslims include all of it together as equally holy for the most part. They don't really distinguish that much. The common Muslim, in his mind, they're equally good.
Have the books been, or have they been analyzed as extensively as, say, the Gospels in terms of form criticism, source criticism? In other words, how
yeah,
it's put together?
It's a great question. And this is at the end. Yes. I was going to allude to this at the end, the fact that the whole sort of rationalism that Christianity has had to deal with has not hit the Muslim world. And it's now hitting. I mean, really what the Satanic Verses represents, you know, the book, the Satanic Verses, why it was such a shock was here is a person out of a Muslim tradition who is striking right at the heart of Muslim belief and practice. I mean, he's bringing out something out of their closet which is so personal and so scary, because what the Islam Satanic Verses deals with is a period in Muhammad's life where he allowed the other Arabs to continue to worship two female gods, which were, you know, really was pagan. And then he later received another message which said, this is not okay, this is bad, this was from Satan. Well, then suddenly this calls into question the authenticity of everything else he said. How do they know when one revelation was from Satan and one was from God? And so this is something that's sort of covered over and nobody wants to talk about in Islamic tradition. And nobody does. You just don't discuss it. It's too close to home. But I think over the next century we'll see a tradition develop of Islamic criticism. But to this day, most Muslim societies cannot handle it. It's too political. It's very, very threatening.
I, last week, as a matter of fact, got into a discussion with an Islamic woman. Actually, she's from Pakistan, Muslim, and she said that that is the one true religion, that there is no error in that religion at all. And she just couldn't understand how our Bible could have been translated. It needed to be the one language, and she was talking about, you know, Arabic with the Quran, and that's how it should be, and that you should never translate out of the original translation or the original language.
Well, of course, the Quran has been translated, so, you know, that's already been done.
But she sort of indicated that that was...
heresy.
Yeah, you can buy into that one.
That's right.
You only should really read
that's
it
right.
in Arabic.
You know, what this reflects, if you can think of in European tradition, we have a parallel, and that would be the Middle Ages. And if you can just think of the Muslim world today and set it back to the Middle Ages of Christendom, there's a lot of parallels where, you know, there was one doctrine that was accepted and everybody believed it, and then rationalism came along and the scientific revolution and the tremendous conflict, you know, Galileo and Copernicus and all these people, you know, struggling with authorities and who's going to win the battle. And this is what's happening in the Muslim world. Is science going to undermine religion? And so the common person is very threatened by that kind of talk. So, you know, people want certainty. They want one thing to believe, and that's all. They don't want to deal with, you know, the difficult, you know, confusing questions.
Related question to my earlier one. Did Muhammad write any of these down himself?
He was illiterate, yeah. Presumably. So his followers did. They first memorized them,
right,
and then later wrote them down. But there were different versions.
So there's an oral tradition behind it, just the Gospels.
Oh, yeah. They were, you know, Arabs today are much more oral. They love to tell stories. They do not like reading in general. And so in our language institute, we always have a harder time with the writing aspect of English, where the Japanese is the reverse. Their writing is better, their oral English is worse. Arabs are great learning English orally.
And that's the thing I think still today about Islam, is that there are some Muslims who are very learned and have read the Quran and know what it says, but in general, a lot of my conversations have been with Muslims who only know what's been sort of told to them or passed on to them orally, but haven't actually sat down and read the Quran. And at one point I used to know more about, I mean, I had read part of the Quran and could quote things from it, which would, oh, I didn't know that was in the Quran, you know. And there are some references to Christ in there that can be interpreted a couple of ways. And when you call them up to them, they're very surprised. So they're still not well read in their book, even though they claim to be good Muslims. As opposed to, there are
nobody says
Muslims,
he's a good Muslim though.
Well, I mean, but
they would say they're a believer, that they try hard, but nobody would claim to be okay in God's eyes. I mean, this is a
real, there's not a way of
interesting
being okay
aspect of Islam is the sense that we won't know until we die. You know, we will be on the scale, and God will judge us, and we just hope He's merciful. It's a very different way of feeling in the Lutheran tradition that many of you are very familiar with. Grace is a very important aspect of that, the sense that, you know, I know I'm forgiven. This is something Muslims just do not sense at all. And I've never met a Muslim who said, I'm a good Muslim, I know that God loves me, I'm going to heaven. You'll never find a Muslim who will say that, because they wait, they're hanging in the balance until the day of judgment.
In yesterday's session, you mentioned how 85% of the general population is illiterate, or some of that. Mm-hmm. Just, I don't know exactly where, but generally speaking, I'm thinking back to the statements that were, people just need something that's solid and infallible, and I was going to, it's halfway a question statement, as education levels rise, mm-hmm. potential for more and more questioning of the old order. Mm-hmm. Is that
exactly
a valid statement?
Exactly. As, you know, particularly science. I mean, science, as in Christendom, poses a tremendous threat to religious certainty. And, you know, it doesn't mean that religion isn't valid, but to the common person, when you go into the classroom and you hear people saying, well, there may or may not be a God, this is how the universe, you know, those kinds of things, it really is a shock.
An apparent contradiction. Mm-hmm. All through the Dark Ages in Europe, Islam was very much an enlightened mm-hmm. culture, and algebra was derived, mm-hmm. that's their line mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. And my point being is they were very, very much scientists
right.
early on.
Right. A small minority. They were very enlightened. The Islamic philosophers, I'm very interested in that area, Islamic philosophy in particular. But, you know, they were the fringe, and the general population was, of course, illiterate and knew very little about what was going on in these educated circles. What you'd have is a court with an astronomer, a poet, and so on, a very learned person, and he would have some disciples who would be learning from him. And there was tremendous educational exchange, but perhaps with 1% of the population. When it got to the point where they were moving further and further away from Orthodox Islam, it became a threat. It even threatened the political structures. So finally, by the 13th century, all of this innovation was squashed. And from the 1300s to the 1800s, Islam just more or less stagnated. And this is the great question of the historian, Middle Eastern historian, is what happened to this great golden era of Islam?
I thought Suleiman's power was in the, like, Constantinople fell in 1541.
Right.
So I thought,
yes.
Is that a military, but not a religious?
Exactly. I mean, the Ottoman Empire was a tremendous military power.
But not religious.
But as far as philosophical innovation, there was nothing going on under him. It was a tremendous trading capital, you know, that is Istanbul. And, you know, there's tremendous political power, but as far as development of science, thought, and so on, literature, there was some literature going, poetry and so on, but it wasn't popular in his day to be an innovative kind of thinker, as it was during the Abbasids in Iraq, what's now Iraq. Yeah. So, excellent questions. Yeah. Did somebody?
Yeah, I've got a few questions. Within this religious tradition, and also with the apparent power of the religious clerics, I guess you could say, can anyone become a religious leader within this Islam tradition, or is there a family of clerics, or how does that form today?
That's a good question. Yeah. There are families that have the tradition of being Islamic leaders, and so the son of a mullah is more likely to become a mullah because of the prestige of his father. So they do have that kind of differentiation. You have trader families, and there is a real hierarchy of political types, you know, military types, religious types, and so on. Although a common peasant boy could be sent off to a religious school, and if he was very astute, could end up being made a mullah.
What percentage of the world population are the Muslims versus the Christian?
About 26%.
26%. What's the Christian?
About 29% to 30%.
Oh, we are more?
Yes. Oh, Christian okay. population, that's using the term loosely, uh-huh. is about, well, what is it? Oh, it varies so much. I mean, Christian population has been as high as 33-34%, but seems to be dropping percentage-wise. Muslim population was about a fifth, and it's moving up. So they're coming closer and closer together. It used to be, you know, 1.5 billion Christians, 800 million Muslims. Now it's maybe 1.1 billion Muslims, and, you know, so it's evening out.
Yeah. Okay.
Shall we move on? I did want to mention this book here, as far as resources, Bill Musk, The Unseen Face of Islam, which deals with folk Islam. And really, to know Muslim people, rather than Islamic teaching as a formal thing, to know Muslim people, this is an excellent resource. Because if you just travel the Muslim world, these are the practices and beliefs you'll run into. That is belief in the evil eye, in evil spirits. Here, an example of what they might do, is say a boy is sick. I saw it in a film one time. Doctor takes a bowl and he writes an Islamic verse in it, and then he puts some water in it, washes it around, and the boy drinks it. And by drinking that water with the Islamic verse in it, that's going to help him. Or they'll wear amulets, you know, and ward off evil spirits with that.
You're also never supposed to like compliment a newborn baby by saying, oh, isn't he or she beautiful? Because that then can bring on evil things.
The evil eye.
Right.
We'll
so you're supposed
jealous.
To say praise yeah. to God in Arabic when you see a new baby. But you're never supposed to compliment them. Now, I had read all these folk things before we went to Kuwait, so I was real careful about some of the things I said. Now, the city people have become much more sophisticated, and if you mention that to them, they'll laugh at you. But you know, they'll say, "Oh no, we don't bother about." Because our Kuwaiti family's daughter had a baby when we're there, and I says, "Now, what was it in Arabic that I say, you know, to a new baby?" And they said, "Well, what do you mean?" I says, "Well, I shouldn't say that she's beautiful, right?" And they said, "Oh no, we say that." So I said that. But if I had been in a tribal kind of in a Bedouin type situation, then that would have been a forbidden thing to say.
Let me ask a question for you to get to sort of chew on a little bit. You've all heard the term Islamic fundamentalism, right? And Islamic fanatic. I mean, these are the terms that are often used to describe the Muslim people. Is that your impression of Muslim people in general? I mean, what impressions do you have of Muslim people as a whole?
I'll try to peel that one. I mean, just like the term applies to me, fanatics, and not everyone in a cross section, a very small section of the population mm-hmm. is that extreme to the right. Mm-hmm. So, no, not at all. In general, just you come across your Charles Manson, or you come across your one individual who's mm-hmm. just really weird, and you call him a fanatic.
Mm-hmm. And then again, until like a few months ago, my total perception of the Middle East was what I got over the media.
Mm-hmm.
And what they portrayed was that small percentage. Mm-hmm. And I had no other base.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Those two words are used, I'd say, more often than not, in media things, with the fanatic and Islam.
And fundamentalists.
And fundamentalists.
Yeah. You don't hear them usually referring to people as Islamic nice guys. You know, it's
according to some, there are none.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But the only Muslims I have ever met are absolutely positive that they are right.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not a lot of...
Although, I mean, there are many that I've met who are...
Right, you mean...
About their religious beliefs.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And these are people that are in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting about that is that I think it's quite common for people when they go to another country to become maybe a little more defensive than they would be in their own country. Mm-hmm. And so the irony there is that the people we meet sometimes are a little more outspoken than they would be back home. So when they're in their own territory, they're comfortable and they can be very gracious and sort of, well, you know, maybe your religion is okay. But when they're here, they're confronted by being a minority and being despised in many cases, and sometimes they're, you know, they become a little more aggressive in their speech. And that's something I've observed personally. Does that make sense that you might be encountering some of that?
And you know, by that I just meant the only mm-hmm. way I can
right.
observe
sure.
and an observation
sure.
about
yeah.
this is observing the people that I know who
right.
are
Muslim. I guess I'm asking the question, did you sense that maybe they did feel a little defensive or?
Well, in a couple of cases, yes. But and I'm not saying this had anything to do with their behavior towards me or the
right.
type of people
right.
they were.
Yeah.
It's just that you just didn't discuss religion because
right.
they were right.
Right.
And,
statement.
Hmm.
In a book written by a journalist recently, and I can't remember his name, so my source is not very well, but he wrote a book, and he was in Iran during the hostage crisis. And this is going to tie into the image that everyone's a fanatic.
Mm-hmm.
The images on the television every day were just riotous people burning flags all the time. But he was there, and he said one day in his hotel window, calm street, and a television crew pulled up in the middle of the corner, just any corner on just an everyday street, and pulled out their cameras. And as soon as the cameras came out, then a very small group of people got around them that would see their cameras, and they would generate their own, the camera crew would generate a
demonstration.
But that from his hotel window, he could see people just shopping, and others standing on the corner watching these idiots over here in front, you know, dancing in front of the camera. But all that we could see, all I certainly saw during the hostage crisis was the people screaming and shouting. And you got the illusion that it was a very big crowd because the cameras were so close. But if you could have backed off, you would have saw it was only 100 people or a very small number.
You know, it's interesting, you know, today our society here, you know, the editor says, go find a story.
Right.
Go over there. Go create a story.
Right.
You know, just step outside.
That's a good...
Can I say something on that? Uh-huh. A kid that I know, high school kids in West Seattle, they had a little melee, didn't amount to nothing. They're just standing there. The newsmen finally show up, and they want them to reenact the scene. And I thought, what kind of news is this?
That's
I think
great.
Yeah. Knew, I mean, like, if it can happen in this country,
yeah.
how bad is it going to be in a foreign country
yeah.
over there with ignorant people?
What I see on the news, or what I saw before we became a little more educated as to what was going on, was sheiks driving Mercedes, hating the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like night after night on the news, they are always in a Mercedes, always had big butts, and, you know, bad-mouthed the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they did drive a lot of Mercedes over
in Kuwait.
In Kuwait. It was
yeah.
interesting. I was almost run over by a Silver Shadow one day crossing the street, a Rolls Royce. Gee, you know, what a way to go. The most expensive car I've almost been hit by. But they never. The hating the U.S. wasn't a common sight, at least in Kuwait, my experience.
Let me ask this in the reverse. Does Islamic fundamentalism mean anything to Muslims?
Well, that's what I'm getting at, ultimately, is that... And before I get into that, I did want to touch on this issue of media, because the media is like looking through the wrong end of a telescope, you know, and focusing in on just a teeny little portion of what's really going on. But the Muslim view is that, number one, they aren't they don't view themselves as fanatics in general. They view that they realize that there is a segment of their own population that is very radical. But in general, I don't think they would use the term anyway. I don't recall an Arabic term being used like that. In general, what they would refer to is something like the true religion. You know, the real believer. Believers who are serious about their faith, you know. And so they make a distinction between people who believe in Islam for real and are serious about it versus people who are Muslim in name only, who are not sincere about it. And they're very critical of, you know, within their own cultures, of one another. You know, those who are more sophisticated, cosmopolitan, are very critical of the, say, less educated people who are more sort of devoted to their faith. And then the village people, for example, are very critical of the political leaders and the wealthy upper class people who are not real sincere. And they feel like the poor village people feel like they are the sincere Muslims, the true Muslims, and they are being governed by these corrupt, insincere people. So, for example, the Saudi regime is, by and large, despised throughout the Muslim world as being people that are hypocritical, people that are totally insincere about their faith.
Well, the reason I raised that was, I'm sure you're familiar with, I guess it was Bernard Lewis's article in The Atlantic last year called The Roots of Muslim Rage. Mm. And he talked about, in a sense, the Western influence in the Middle East and the backlash against that. So
right.
He argued that the fundamentalist perspective came more not out of a sense of desire to be sort of fundamentalist in a religious sense, but a reaction against that corrupting
right.
influence that they don't associate with the Saudis. And
right. Now, that's what I try to distinguish here is the political from the religious. Now, Islam does combine the two. That's something that's so different for us, is that Islam includes law. Law is the most important aspect of Islam. Not politics, not theology, not practice, but law. And that's something that's very, very hard for us to grasp. The countries that are Muslim are governed by Islamic law. So the religion governs your daily kind of, you know, what is legal, what is illegal, sort of thing. But that's why I choose the word Islamic Reform Movement, because what that refers to is that there's this groundswell in the Middle East now of wanting to reform society for the better, to have a moral society. Then there's the political backlash, as you say, against the Western domination, against Western cultural influences, and a real kind of a negative feeling about what the West, they consider the West sort of the enemy in this case. But yeah, you're right. It's the anger that we see is directed at, is out of frustration, you know, for economic reasons, political reasons. The Islamic Reform Movement is people saying we have a moral problem in our society. We need, and this is a very quiet movement. It's just your average person who says, well, you know, our leaders are corrupt. We need to become, go back to our faith, go back to our roots. And so those are two very different things. And fundamentalism sort of combines them together in a very messy kind of way. And you see, I'm trying to separate out what is a kind of sincere, heartfelt feeling among Muslims to have a moral society versus a political kind of anti-Western movement because of, you know, colonialism and domination.
How does each one of those play out then in the Arab-Israeli? I mean,
well, this is very interesting. Now, what most people in the West don't realize is that the PLO is not supported by the Muslim organizations. So we think of the PLO as this, you know, radical anti-Western group, but the PLO is secular, nationalist. And the Islamic groups consider that to be just the opposite of what they want. The Islamic groups want to have a kind of Islamic unity in the Muslim world. So the PLO is actually opposed by Islamic groups because the PLO wants a nation state for Palestinians. And we'll get into that more tomorrow.
In Kuwait, after the war, is there, you know, you were talking about the reform, and even in Saudi Arabia, but especially in Kuwait, when a lot of people left, but some people stayed. Among those who stayed, then, is there a feeling of a need to reform? Because that then, as their leaders came back, could that possibly be the beginning of something?
You're talking political reform, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I listened to a debate between a Kuwaiti government official, and a young woman. And the young woman was apparently one of the leaders in the underground movement, Kuwait underground movement, during the occupation. And she was pushing, you know, when are we going to have those open? And of course, you've got your lovely American media guy who's, you know, in there trying to start democracy all by himself. But she was really pushing this Kuwaiti official who had fled Kuwait during the occupation. For, you know, when are we going to have our free elections, and when are we going to, you know, do all these different reforms and stuff? And he was waffling a bit. Our impression has been, or at least my impression has been, that when we were there, the Emir of Kuwait was thought of as an okay guy. I mean, really, there wasn't much he did. He was a benevolent ruler. There was free, you know, no taxes, free medical care. There was abundant supplies of rice and sugar and certain staples that anybody could get for next to nothing, as well as just a regular grocery store, sort of on the Safeway variety. And everybody lived happy and well, and you didn't pay for utilities and all that sort of thing. And then, but he made several mistakes at the end of the war. Number one, first of all, he fled, of course, which was necessary for him to remain alive. Living in a Hilton or wherever it was in Geneva wasn't necessarily the best move, but he wasn't the first back. It was the Crown Prince was the first back, and from what we've understood, the Crown Prince is pretty highly revered right now, and the Emir is not. So they keep talking about free elections for. They had a parliament. He kept dismissing the parliament at various points due to some infighting and. It was becoming unstable, so he just dismissed the parliament. So they have talked of elections. I think one of the dates I heard was in the fall of 92. They talked about having elections, but then for those who were in Kuwait who really fought for, you know, who laid down their lives during the occupation, don't want to wait that long for those kind of reforms to happen. He hasn't really shown... The Emir hasn't shown some of the leadership that's necessary to build the country back up, to, you know, get things moving again. So I don't know if that answers your question, but...
I just wondered if that could start.
Yeah, I think that it looked like things were going to happen more quickly, but things don't happen quickly there like they happen here, you know? I mean, we went... How long did it take? It took us 2 months, 3 months to get a married housing. Arrangement. We were in Kuwait for, we actually had a single bed for the first couple of months that we lived there, and in single housing, and we'd go every day and talk to the guy and have tea with the guy, and, you know, eventually we got a married housing arrangement, and then we had two single beds that had no legs at the foot of the bed, you know, so then we just gave up and we got our own wood and made ends to the bed, but things don't happen in the same kind of pace that they happen here. So it may be impetus for some political change in Kuwait, but it's not one of those things you want to hold your breath on.
I'd like to get back on Islam and the Islamic reform, because this issue of fundamentalism and so on is something that I feel needs to really be clarified in the West so that we can try to avoid stereotyping and so on. But every time you watch a film documentary on Islam, this is what you're going to hear. And I recorded this up in my room. That's the beginning of the call to prayer, and it sounds very sort of oriental and mysterious and all of that. Basically, we had this one American family that would hear this, and the first part they thought was something like bonk wonk, was the way that they interpreted it. What it starts off saying is, God is great. God is great, or God is the greatest. And then it says, there is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet, and then it calls to prayer. Life is for prayer. And I guess I want to sort of demystify Islam for Western people. I want people to understand that that Muslims in general, what they're most interested in is their own personal livelihood. That is, the Islamic world is not this monolithic enemy of the West. I've met hundreds of Muslims, and for the most part, they're very happy that I'm a Christian. It doesn't bother them in the least. They'd like me to be a Muslim, but as long as I'm a good Christian, that's okay. They have a harder time if I'm an atheist. That's one thing, they just
you
have
actually,
a very difficult time.
Yeah,
with. And you can't enter, yeah.
I was going to say, you have to declare your religion on your visa application for Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf countries. And if you declare atheist, they won't let you in. So we had a lot of people who claimed to be Christians that were there that had some really interesting ideas. But they basically, people knew that. So even if you were an atheist, if you wanted to go to Kuwait, you'd have to write Christian on your visa application.
Just to give you a sense as to the level at which Muslim people in general are operating on, the kinds of things that they're interested in, this is something that was given to my parents in 1955 by a couple of ladies that were in Iran at the time. And this was written, handwritten, and I can't quite make out the Arabic. I can read parts of it. But what it says is, God increases friendship between people's hearts. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the Compassionate, God says in the Quran, marry someone good. If you are poor, God will make you rich by His grace. For God is the open-handed and all-knowing, and to His name be the glory. So you see the level at which people operate. Religion gives life a kind of stability. They go to their faith for encouragement, advice on marriage, rules on how to live and that sort of thing. That's the level that most Muslims live. And so, you know, religion gives life certainty. And I think that's reflected in your friend's comments that, well, you can't question it because then you suddenly upset the whole apple cart. Life becomes very difficult to figure out. And Muslim people in general have, one of the reasons for the reform movement is because Western society has brought uncertainty, has brought fear, has brought a sense of where are we going? And so for the past several decades, people have gone back to Islam thinking that, well, this will give them confidence, this will give them maybe an identity, a way to counter Western influence. I think it's sort of a pendulum kind of effect. And in Iran today, after the Iranian Revolution and the Islamic Revolution, it went very much to the extreme on one end. We see it swinging back already in 10 years, which is much more rapid than many might have predicted. And the Islamic leaders in Iran saying things like, well, you know, marriages of convenience in order to have sex are okay. People need to have some fun. This is something that the president recently said. in Iran. And, you know, I mean, this is an Islamic, this is a practice that's been accepted in the region. And in here we have other forms of the same thing. I mean, in Europe you had, people had mistresses and that sort of thing as sort of an acceptable means of fooling around. And so here you have this supposedly very strict Muslim society, and yet the president says this, and nobody, I'm sure there was some criticism, but, it, you know, he's still in power. You have a question?
Are there differences in terms of the specific understanding of reform between the Sunni and the Shia and the Sufis? I mean, are
these
they...
Two?
Yeah, I mean, do they understand reform differently, and is there conflicts between
them? That's a real... Excellent question. Let me get yours, and then we'll deal with that one.
When they're called to prayer, do they have a learned prayer, or do they have a spontaneous?
No, it's a learned prayer.
So there's a same prayer all
Interestingly enough, I've heard many, many incidents of Muslims going to their Christian neighbors for prayer, because Christians have the tradition of praying for sickness and various needs, and Muslims, in contrast, pray, you know, worship to God and sort of submission to God, and pray from the Quran. But they don't have a tradition where you sit around in the family and say, well, let's pray about so-and-so's bad knee or something. Yeah. And so they almost believe that Christians have the sort of a special pipeline to healing. And it's a very interesting interplay between...
But then their criticism, you know, on the other hand, their criticism of Christians is that we don't thank God very often, but we sort of see God as our handmaiden that we can request things from all the time, and that we don't, you know, don't praise God and thank God enough. So that was a good challenge to me.
As far as Shia and Sunni, we just have a couple minutes left. Let's take a look at the map again. The Sunnis represent kind of your standard Islamic faith, and they go from throughout much of the peninsula into Turkey. The Kurdish people are Sunni. Egypt and North Africa is Sunni. And then Iran is about 96% Shia. And so Iran is the main Shia country. And then Afghanistan is split between Sunni and Shia, as well as some of the Gulf countries. So during the Khomeini's period, this was why the Gulf countries were so worried, because they felt that some of these people would be influenced. And also, one of the fatal mistakes Saddam made was the idea that he thought, well, these Arab Sunnis down here would, Arab origin Iranians, would come to his side when he attacked Iran, and they didn't. So that was a poor miscalculation. What happened was that the Shia were a fairly small minority, perhaps 5-10% of the population. And in the 1600s, the Iranian rulers decided to utilize a Shia sect to get political support, and they declared this area Shia. And they were just a small minority at the time. But then quickly this became a badge of not being under the Ottomans, you see, a badge of being Iranian. And so initially it was resisted, but within a century all of Iran had become Shia. Well, what does it mean for faith and practice? Basically, Shiism has taken on a very Iranian characteristic, which is the concentration of influence in the hands of religious leaders in all the little villages. So the village leader, or the pir, he's the old man of the village, takes on a very important role in Iranian society throughout the countryside. And so what it means is that Shia leaders, religious leaders, are more political in general than the Sunni religious leaders. This traditional Islamic leader is not a political figure. And so this is one of the ironies of this fundamentalism issue, is that most of the Muslim world, religious leaders, their tendency is not to be political. However, with these corrupt governments who are not responsive, the only way people can get representation is through their religious leaders. So it almost forces the religious leaders to be political. even though that's not their natural tendency. Throughout much of Muslim history, religious leaders are used by the political leader to be legitimate. So the first thing the political leader does when he becomes the new caliph or the new king is he orders in the call to prayer on Friday, in the Friday prayer, that the guy who's doing the prayer is supposed to announce that he is who the ruler is and pray for the ruler. And that was sort of the signal of authenticity. But in fact, in early Islam, the caliph himself gave the Friday prayer.
I recall at the onset of the Gulf War, there was a question within the American media as to how Islamic Saddam was. And there was, Saddam would pray and the TV cameras would be there to watch him pray. It's the same type of
right.
idea you're talking about.
And he called for jihad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You've heard jihad? I mean, this is such a joke. I mean, Saddam, when he calls for a holy war, I had to laugh because... I mean, there isn't a Muslim alive who considered Saddam any kind of a religious example. The guy was basically anti-Islamic, if anything. He put to death Muslim leaders in Iraq who were part of the Muslim Brotherhood. And so he was hated by Muslims, the real believers. And, of course, the idea, there was even some... suggestion in Western papers that Iran would come in on his side. And I thought, well, I mean, they just would have absolutely no reason to join a holy war on his side. I mean, number one, he's not holy. Number one, number two, they hate his guts. And sure, they dislike the U.S. for various, recent historical reasons, but they were not all going to suddenly rise up and follow Saddam. The guy needs to be a genuine Muslim, for one thing.
60 Minutes, Mike Wallace interviewed, did you see that? The Iranian people in a hospital.
Yeah, that was really interesting.
But they said that they didn't like the U.S. They
right.
were still on the side of Saddam. They hoped he would win out.
Right. Well, obviously...
In Iraq, you mean? He was
Iranians...
Iraq. Iraq.
This was Iran.
Was in Iran.
In Tehran.
Iran.
And he interviewed university students. I thought it was very interesting. You noticed their English was very good. Mm-hmm. And these Iranians were saying, yeah, well, they aren't going to cheer for the U.S. Mm-hmm. On Monday, I made the statement that when the U.S. went in, most third world countries were not worried about Iraq. They were worried about what the U.S. was going to do. In other words... from their perspective, the U.S. is this behemoth, this incredible superpower, and Iraq, by comparison, is a third-rate nothing. I mean, what has Iraq accomplished militarily? They never accomplished anything. They attacked Iran, were beaten back to their borders. And so Iraq had never militarily accomplished anything. And so, from the Middle Eastern perspective, Iraq was not a great power. So they were. That's why they were not all that excited about this Western alliance, because to them it's like, oh, it's Britain all over again. You see? That's the Middle Eastern perspective. They were not cheering for the coalition. But they knew Iraq would lose. I mean, there was no question in anyone's mind that Iraq would be crushed.
But you sort of think that they were thinking, well, maybe this guy's a madman, so he needs to be removed from power. But they were saying, oh, well, we're cheering for him.
Well, politics makes strange bedfellows, Your enemy, the whole thing about your enemy's enemy is your friend kind of thing. So because Iraq was the enemy of the U.S., Iraq was Iran's friend for that period of time. But now that the war's over, I mean, you're not going to see Iran and Iraq becoming best bosom buddies. They've been fighting for, between Iraq and Iran, maybe five centuries. So, that was,
The origins of their hatred for each other.
Well, it's just power, struggle for power. You have a power center here and a power center here, and fighting over this territory. I mean, the boundary has been going back and forth for centuries and centuries.
Well, isn't the Tigris and Euphrates right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, and this is a very important water source. Although in Iran they do have the Karun River. I used to live in Ahvaz, which is on the Karun. But yeah, they would like to have this water water source there. That's a good point. Water is real important. Yeah.
What do you think of the magazine of the Iranical World?
I like the pictures very much. it's propaganda. You know, Aramco is the Arab American oil company, and it's propaganda for the Middle East and the Muslim world. It doesn't bother me. I can read propaganda and enjoy the pictures, and they have some really nice articles. They do.